This hour of the Jason Rance Show is brought to you by You Build It. Lots of news on this breaking news night is happening all around the world and right here at home. So let's find out what's trending.
What's trending? Happening now.
So the big news, of course, is the Senate just voted to confirm Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. This was the third justice appointed to the Supreme Court by President Trump, the most of any president since Ronald Reagan. The vote was 52-48, which is what we expected in tonight's tally. The vote marked the end of this process to confirm Amy Coney Barrett, one that lasted about 40 days after Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, somewhat unexpectedly as far as the timing is concerned. Right now, we've got Democrats who are complaining about the process, saying that this was a sham and that it was illegitimate. We have, for example, Representative Pramila Jayapal, the Democrat from here in Seattle, tweeting McConnell, speaking of Mitch McConnell, McConnell says elections have consequences. Well, so does Republicans' failed leadership. We won't forget. In this case, the leadership was not a failure. The leadership led to a conservative justice being put onto the Supreme Court just days before an election. That's not failed leadership. That's quite the opposite. That's actual leadership. That is a success. In doing so, conservatives now have control of the Supreme Court as of right now. Now, obviously, when you look ahead to the coming term, which we, of course, hope will be under a second term for the president, you understand that there are Supreme Court justices like, for example, Clarence Thomas, who, by the way, is going to be swearing in Amy Coney Barrett later tonight. But he's 72 years old, and so there is the potential for him maybe to step down. No imminent reason to believe that that's happening, but it's certainly possible. If that is something that ends up happening, you want that seat to be replaced by another conservative. And you're not going to get that under a Joe Biden administration. Most obviously. The question then shifts now into whether or not there's going to be some attempt by the Democratic Party to pack the courts. You have a whole bunch of people on the left trying to shift the definition of what court packing actually means. Court packing to Democrats is now being presented as if it simply means filling seats that are vacated, filling judicial vacancies, which of course is not court packing. Court packing actually means, in the context in which everyone is talking about it, at least the ones who are being honest about it, means just adding justices to the bench, which is a process that can happen despite being deeply unpopular, according to polls. But it's something that can, in fact, happen if Democrats take control of the Senate. You'll have to remember, and Mitch McConnell, I thought, did a very good job of pointing this out in his remarks before the actual vote. The reason why you can get a Supreme Court nomination through with 52 votes rather than 60 votes is that Harry Reid, then Democratic Senate Majority Leader, led the effort to get rid of the filibuster on judicial nominees. And as Mitch McConnell laid out in his speech, the bed that the Democrats are now lying in, they're responsible. They're the ones who did this. And at the time, Republicans said, don't do it. Don't do it. You're going to regret the day that you get rid of judicial filibusters. They did it anyway. They did it anyway. And who won out in this? The very party that said, don't do it. The very party that said, do not do it. It's rather remarkable. If that's the case. So this is a huge night. A huge night for this country. So congratulations to now Justice Amy Coney Barrett. That sounds good, doesn't it? Justice Amy Coney Barrett. I like that.
Sounds good. It's been a long time coming, so it's nice that you can finally say...
I mean, 40 days. Yeah. Although technically long time coming because we expected she was going to be put on this court as a nominee. They were just waiting for that third appointment possibility because they didn't want to put in, for example, Brett Kavanaugh for a female justice in Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
That's exactly what I meant.
Is that what?
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
That was my exact message when I was sending that across.
You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. When we come back, we're going to dive into another legal issue. In fact, Cassandra Lopez Shaw is going to stop by. She is running for Superior Court judge on the Snohomish County Superior Court, I should say. Her opponent, Robert Grant, was on the show at 3:15. So now equal time, since this is one of the only, or this is, at least in Snohomish County, the one contested election for judge. She's going to be stopping by in a moment. Find me on Twitter, twitter.com/JasonRants. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending at home?
Of the judicial positions up for vote in Snohomish County for you guys to weigh in on, and you, as you've got those ballots in hand, only one is actually contested. The race to replace Judge Eric Lucas, who is retiring. It's a race between Cassandra Lopez Shaw and Robert Grant. Robert joined us earlier today, and now Cassandra joins us. She's a former public defender. She's a current attorney in private practice who has spent the last 17 years or so working on a whole different areas of legal fields, including civil, family, and immigration law. She joins me now, Cassandra Lopez Shaw. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So what did you learn in either private practice or as a public defender that makes you uniquely qualified to be a judge?
Well, more specifically, being in my office with my clients and their very concerned families and girlfriends and mothers, you really learn a lot about human nature. And you really learn the cause and effect of how cases affect a whole family. And so that, I think, is the biggest thing that I bring that is different than my opponent. I know exactly. I fight really hard. I fight really, really hard to not have negative effects on my clients that will affect their whole family or will, for example, have them lose their children as a result. And so that is very specific to defense work. Different than prosecution work.
Yeah.
It's that very personal, in your office, very close up, intimate sort of human contact that I think would make me a very good judge and very thoughtful and very patient. Because I spend lots of hours explaining things to my clients, and so if I were on the bench, it would be no different. I would take the time necessary so people would understand what's going on.
So I have a question, a version of which I asked Robert, but from a slightly different perspective of, in your case, how as a judge would you keep the pro-defender bias potentially that you have out of any of the decisions that you make?
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of people ask me that, but you know, when I look at a case, I always look at it as a prosecutor. It's because that's how I'm successful. I actually look at see how a prosecutor would try my case, what are the best evidentiary facts, and I build the case from a prosecutor perspective, and then I reverse engineer it. So my first thought is not always defense, actually. That's not like the first thing that I jump to. My first thought is facts. What are the facts? And essentially, what is the evidence that's being presented, and what is the most damaging evidence? So I think as a judge, for me to think about facts and then apply the law is exactly what people want.
Well, it's always kind of interesting, I suppose, from a public defender perspective. The thinking is, presumably, if everything is going well, a prosecutor won't bring charges unless he or she believes that it could actually win in court. And presumably, if you are defending someone, it means the prosecutor thinks they have the actual evidence. And so in a lot of cases, public defenders are defending people who are guilty, right? So how do you prioritize just internally pushing aside maybe what you think the guilt is of a client versus knowing that they have the right to a really good defense?
Well, first of all, I never ask. I never ask my clients, truthfully. And the reason why is because I speak a lot to children in high schools and middle schools. They always ask me, how can you defend someone who you know is guilty? Well, I don't know that because I don't ask that question. So one, I do my constitutional right of giving them a defense, period. But I will tell you, I have had many cases where my clients were innocent and the prosecutors went forward anyway, and the jury found my client not guilty, and then the jury stayed after and chastised the prosecutor because they just didn't believe the evidence was there and they thought it was pretty simple to see. So I think that both sides can be, you know, colored by their viewpoint a little bit. And I think that's pretty common. Just, it's a competitive thing. You know, we're adversaries. It's, and it's kind of hard to stay on one side sometimes. But for me, you know, I really care about the jurors when they come in and they want to, and they serve on a case of mine. I really want them to go home and tell people, oh, this is some really work. And so for me, how it comes across to them, how it's presented, how people behave in front of them is really important. And so I try not to be biased or aggressive or unprofessional or any of those things in front of them, because that's my ultimate goal, for the community to believe and to have faith in the justice system.
Just joining me, we're talking with Cassandra Lopez Shaw. She is in a race for Snohomish County Superior Court Judge. This is position number eight. She's up against Robert Grant, a prosecutor. There was a quote that you gave to the Everett Herald that I wanted to talk to you about. It's quoted, it's difficult for me, to be quite honest, to justify myself or to feel like I have to quantify my experience when it's so vastly superior. Now, presumably you're saying it's so vastly superior to Robert Grant. Can you explain the context in which you made that statement? Because I have to be honest, when I read it, understanding that sometimes things are taken a little bit out of context, it kind of rubbed me the wrong way. So could you explain that comment?
No, sure. And actually the question was, so this gentleman who interviewed me, his name is Caleb Hunton. He interviewed me last year, and I ran against Paul Thompson, who I worked with at the public defender's office. And so his question to me was, why are you running against Robert this year? And that was my response, because I was like, I chose to run first in December. I had no clue that Mr. Grant was running at all. And why would you presume that? And why do you have to ask the question in that way?
How did you take it then?
He asked Robert that question. Why are you running against Cassandra? She ran last year. Why wouldn't you think she would run again? I mean, and that's why my response was what it was, because I feel like, to be honest, I feel like women who have careers and are accomplished, you know, like, I mean, today's a historical day. You know, Amy Coney Barrett is going to be confirmed today. And, you know, and they asked her similar questions. And I just feel that, you know, women who have established careers, you know, should be treated the way that, you know, men are treated, with some level of esteem. That's all I'm asking.
No, and I think that that's fair. It's a question of, you know, is an honest question, you know, responded to in a way that maybe gives off a slightly different impression from your perspective as to whether or not the question was even asked of Robert. And I have no idea. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. Right. And that's why I wanted to ask you, just because it did seem a little bit weird, because it's like, well, you are running for office. It is a legitimate question to sort of ask, generally speaking, why you're running.
I'm actually glad you picked that up, because some of my friends picked that up. And I'm like, you told me about the interview, and I know what you answered, but it doesn't come off that way in the paper. And I'm like, I know.
Well, I know. I'm glad you cleared that up. So final question for you. You know, this is a nonpartisan race, and it's supposed to be. We don't want to pick a judge, especially in a superior court, based on their ideological perspective. An issue that probably doesn't help, I suppose, even though I don't think you asked for it, was Fuse Washington, which is a progressive local sort of nonprofit group or an activist group. They have endorsed your candidacy over Robert. They don't actually explain per se why they decided to go with you from their political perspective. But when you see something like that, or when a conservative sees something like that, is that not to be a red flag as far as potential bias that they might see?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I've had so many calls about that. So the voters are super educated this year, and they're super involved, and they don't take anything for granted. And they pick up the phone and they call my campaign phone, and they say exactly what you just said. Why should I vote for you when Fuse has, you know, has essentially said you're their candidate and I'm conservative? And they've literally asked me those questions. And so I go back to last year. I had zero endorsements. I chose to run last year on my experience. mm-hmm. which was 17 years across 15 counties, over 200 trials with tons of pro bono hours. And I just ran on my experience. And many people criticized me because I didn't, they couldn't decide if a Republican or if a liberal would endorse me. And so I was criticized and I lost. So this year I sought out endorsements. I didn't seek fuses, but I sought out other endorsements, which I'm sure is what they based their decision on, maybe. But, you know, to be honest, I have 17 years of experience and Mr. Grant has 10. And I cross criminal, civil, family, all the different types of law that a Superior Court judge would see. So I think that it's fair to also say that someone could choose me based on experience.
No, and I think that that's fair. For those of you who want to learn more about the candidate, CassandraForJudge.org, and it's all spelled out, so F-O-R, CassandraForJudge.org. And, of course, if you want to check out my interview with Robert, the opponent, you can check it out on the podcast. Cassandra Lopez Shaw, thank you so much for stopping by. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason. Bye.
Bye-bye. Again, that website, CassandraForJudge.org. You're listening to The Jason Rantz Show. The Jason Rantz Show live on this Monday afternoon, a historic afternoon in which Judge Amy Coney Barrett has been confirmed as the next justice on the Supreme Court. She's going to be sworn in later this evening in just about 30 minutes or so by Justice Clarence Thomas. So that's a huge, huge, huge win for the conservative movement, for, of course, I would argue, this country. I've been working on a story, or I should say a series of stories, for a while now that I plan to unveil over the course of this week. And it all has to do with teachers who are, in my view, abusing their position to indoctrinate kids. Some of the stories are more egregious than others. In fact, tomorrow's a good one.
You got a good one for tomorrow?
Oh, tomorrow's especially good. In fact, if you follow me on Facebook or Twitter, you'll get a glimpse of it later this evening. But I want to talk today about one out of Tacoma, where on the surface, maybe it doesn't seem all that bad. It's bad, but maybe you're saying, oh, it's, in this case, you know, it's just an elective teacher, probably not going to be teaching anymore. Okay, let's go through it. Because I would argue that when you send your kids to the classroom, digital or otherwise, the expectation is that it's going to be free of political bias. That's my expectation. That's your expectation. Unfortunately, in Tacoma with an elective teacher, she decided to recruit her students to join progressive political campaigns. Wasn't all. That adjunct teacher Emily Pickney, who's an area activist out of Tacoma, was doing, because she decided to push a slew of progressive political positions on students during her remote classes. Now, this class, Environmental and Social Justice, was taught at three of the specialty schools in Tacoma, Science and Math Institute, the School of the Arts, and the School of Industrial Design, Engineering, and Art. The elective course was for last semester, and it was introduced to juniors and seniors because, according to a spokesperson, they were already talking about the social justice issues in and around the classroom, and there was interest. Okay, fine. That's fine. I have no problem, for example, talking about the Green New Deal. Certainly not during an environmental justice course. That makes total sense to me. However, the expectation should be, when you're talking about these issues, it should be discussed objectively. It should be debated. In fact, you should get multiple perspectives on the topic. But not only does Emily Pickney offer one-sided lectures, she actively recruited students to join political campaigns to push the Green New Deal. That seems to borrow the term of the left, problematic.
Next week, we'll talk a little bit more about the New Green Deal. But I just want to bring that to you now. I specifically am working on the New Green Deal with Washington State. So especially for folks, young folks who want the opportunity to work on some policy during this time, please email me. It'll be really fun and exciting. There's a lot of people who are going to be running for Washington State Senate who support the New Green Deal. That'll be looking for interns, whether that's people to help with the community outreach side or whether that's people to help with these campaigns. But it's important to talk about the different options that we have here, because there's no one way to do things. There's no one way to do government. There's no one way to do economy. And there's no one way to engage with the community.
I mean, I think the latter part is totally fair. But on topics even of environmental justice, students should be getting an objective presentation. There are clearly, very clearly, ideological criticisms of this movement, including, by the way, from other Democrats. And there are, as we've talked about on the show many, many times, conservative policy alternatives to the Green New Deal. But when you have an activist who is posing as a teacher, it's difficult getting different sides to a movement. Now, this to me seemed like clear campaign recruitment. The disagreement comes from the school district. Because the spokesperson told me via email, this is an environmental justice class, remember? The instructor mentioned opportunities for students to extend their learning if they choose. So they don't view this as any kind of political recruitment. And by the way, none of this was a shock to them because they approved of all of the information before it was presented. I suppose if they gave opportunities to multiple campaigns, that would be something else. But the only opportunities presented were progressive campaigns and causes, because it was about being in support of the Green New Deal. There is a Washington-based conservative environmentalist group, of which I'm an advisory board member. It's called the American Conservation Coalition. They didn't get any shout-outs here. If you want to be fair, you would. Now, I reached out to Emily Pinckney, who did not respond. Shocking. Totally shocking, I know. But I was able to find out that at least one of the campaigns that she's been working on is to help progressive Twyna Nobles unseat our Republican friend, State Senator Steve O'Bann, out in University Place. Now, the activism continues. She wanted to pretend that holding illegal immigrants who are criminals beyond being in this country illegally, detaining them at the Northwest Detention Center, is somehow an environmental injustice. But she went down and made the claim to these students, you know what, these people are vulnerable. We're in the middle of a pandemic. People are running the risk of getting sick if they are in detention. Maybe we should release all the criminal illegal immigrants. Now, by the way, at the time she made those comments, you know how many prisoners, detainees, had COVID? Any guesses?
Zero.
Zero. How about now? I mean, this is several months later.
Zero.
Still zero. Oftentimes, you hear activists make ridiculous claims exploiting the pandemic for their political views. Again, multiple sides of an issue were not explored, just one side. Now, I think the topics are class appropriate. These are juniors and seniors, but the partisan presentation is not. I've said this before, I'll say it again. Public schools should not be telling kids what to think. They should be teaching kids how to think, which means you don't get hit up over and over and over again with one-sided material. You get a little bit of a mix. That wasn't the case here. And yes, it was an elective, which is why it's more important. People aren't paying attention to the electives. Now, if you want to help me shine a spotlight on this, text the keyword RANTZ, R-A-N-T-Z, to 1-800-465-8770. I'll send you a link. Text R-A-N-T-Z to 1-800-465-8770, and I will send you a link for you to read, but also post on your Facebook wall and Twitter feed. When we come back, Saul Spady stops by to give us his impression of what's wrong with the polls in this presidential campaign. Welcome back. back to the Jason Rancho on AM 770 KTTH, streaming on the KTTH smartphone app. Entrepreneur, community activist, and former KTTH host Saul Spady has been on the road visiting most of the country with his work he's doing with the American Conservation Coalition, of which I'm an advisory board member. And he has made some interesting observations as we head into this final full week of the election. In fact, he joins me right now on the line from Colorado, where the benefits of electronic vehicles or electric vehicles almost non-existent with this weather. Saul Spady, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Jason. Yeah, I'm standing in a parking lot in Cannon City, Colorado. There was a blizzard last night. If anybody hears cars driving by, that's because our Tesla got stuck. If anybody's a Tesla owner, yeah, it turns out the cars are half as effective in less than 32 degree weather. So that gives me time to sit and think and talk to you about what I've seen driving around the country. And I got to tell you, driving around the country, I just like every single bit of me. And I'm a consultant in politics. I've done the radio. It just says anecdotal data. Trump is going to win, but then all the polls are overwhelmingly going towards Biden. Pollsters are saying Georgia's in play. And I got to tell you, Jason, I don't believe it.
Yeah. And, you know, I've taken this position on the show for the last several years. In fact, back in 2016, I had made the point that if Donald Trump is down by about 5 percentage points in a statewide poll, he's going to win because the polls don't know how to reach a traditional Trump supporter. And it sounds like that's what you're witnessing.
Yeah, I'd say that's definitely a part of it. I'm also seeing something very bizarre in that Americans are afraid of putting up signs. Like, if I want to give a gold star of no fear, it's going to go to the state of Virginia. You cross the state of Virginia's line, like you get in there from Maryland or the Washington, D.C. or something like that, you immediately see signs everywhere. And, like, Maryland's supposedly strong Biden country, but you see a lot of Trump signs to go with the Biden signs, and that was one of the few places I saw Biden signs. But then you cross the line into North Carolina, supposedly this huge swing state, and I mean, I didn't see a sign for miles. Same thing in Minnesota. People are almost afraid of the judgment of their neighbors, and it leads me to believe they might be afraid of even being honest with a pollster. I told you offline, I have a friend whose father is telling them that they are going to definitely not vote for Trump, but then will text me and tell me I need to advocate for Trump because this is an election of a lifetime. If that person is going to lie to a family member, they're going to lie to a pollster.
Yeah, and what's always kind of interesting in deciding this kind of stuff is when you do look at the polls, one thing that does seem to be matching up with the anecdotal evidence is that Trump supporters are very, very enthusiastic versus Biden supporters who are not enthusiastic about the candidate, but are, in fact, enthusiastic about getting rid of Donald Trump. Could that explain why you're not really seeing a whole bunch of Biden signs, but seeing a whole bunch of Trump signs?
Yeah, that's totally true. And I will give you the joke. You know, you do see the Trump shrine, which I have never witnessed before in my political lifetime. You know, you didn't see a shrine for George W. Bush or for that matter, you know, any even Obama. And yet you see those for Trump. But that's still just one voter, in my opinion. I think the bigger factor really is just into the economy, right? As much as you go across the country, coronavirus is topic number one on CNN, but you see this huge variance between the livelihoods of cities like Seattle or Minneapolis or New York and maybe a rural area or the areas around national parks, which are actually, in my opinion, potentially thriving.
Mm-hmm. So what is your ultimate take then on lawn signs? Because I seem to remember when you put on a political consultant hat, the idea of putting out a whole bunch of signs is not all that meaningful to the end result. It's more about meeting candidates. Now, obviously, that is delivered in the context of local races, but how much of that translates to the national level?
Well, to the national level, I think you actually have to look at social media ad spend. And as much as Biden is starting to see some success on Facebook, and they're spending a lot on that side, and he's starting to get Twitter reach that's close to where the president is at. I've been seeing President Trump ads all over YouTube when we have to sit in the Tesla and charge, and of course, watch entertainment because it's boring. And I haven't seen a lot of Biden ads. And, you know, they're pretty damning. It's aggressive stuff. It definitely makes you think twice about voting for Biden in some of these states that are up for grabs. And I want to make a point that, you know, the day that I was going through Georgia and Atlanta, they were saying that Georgia's up for grabs. I didn't see one Biden sign. And when I left my hotel, I saw a young black man wearing a Trump 2020 face mask. So I just don't believe it all, Jason. It's really hard for me to see the national hubbub and believe that this election is over. It's definitely in play. I think it's going to be really close. But Trump has a real shot at winning this thing again.
And of course, on Tuesday night, we go into extended coverage with limited interruptions for our live election night coverage. It all starts at 3 o'clock. It goes through 9 o'clock or a little bit later if we're going to actually get a result. If you're just joining us on the line, we're talking with Saul Spady, who is on a pretty significant road trip across most of the state. If not, you're hitting almost all of the states with the work you're doing with the American Conservation Coalition. And it is kind of interesting because, you know, you set out on this alongside Benji Backer, who is a friend of the show, friend of mine, who is the founder of the American Conservation Coalition. The goal was to highlight the fact that conservatives also care about the environment, and you're out in that Tesla. And in cold weather, you're running into some problems. Take us through exactly how it's been going.
Yeah, for sure. No, it's been a crazy journey. I even told you, Jason, way back when we were talking about my radio show and whether it might have legs in 2020, that I wanted to go across America and see where people's heads were at during the election. And it's been so cool to focus on such a little kind of talked about perspective, which is rural focus on climate change and what I'm starting to call climate action. And it may not surprise our listeners, but conservatives are so much better at putting their money where their mouth is on this issue. We visited a wind turbine factory where they fixed turbines, where we kind of talked with this nuts and bolts guy who has been working in wind for 25 years. He's like, you know, I never thought I'd be an advocate for this, but now I push it as a business every day. We've seen electric trucks. We've talked with the leader from GM. It's been a really exciting topic, but it really has shown me that conservatives have such a strong message. And I do, you know, I wish sometimes the president could get out of his own way and let some of these people that we've talked to, like Dan Crenshaw, Kathy McMorris-Rogers, to really take the front and center on this, because I think their message is strong and powerful. And we've met with both Democrats and Republicans who are pretty middle of the road. And I got to tell you, I've been more convinced by the conservative message of investing in businesses, of using incentives, than the more liberal message of using, let's say, carbon taxes to make this action happen, because it's already happening. So it's, I don't know, it's been super fun, really inspiring. And I really do encourage people to travel America. Even during COVID, you can be safe. You can really see the world, and you can see it by the, you know, these are Fortune 500 executives who are sitting down with us, and we've created a scenario where they feel safe. So I think we should all feel okay slightly opening the economy and getting back to work as safely as possible.
How is the rest of the country dealing with the coronavirus and, you know, the local reaction to people wanting to go back out into the economy? Obviously, here in Washington State, we're being hit with some significant mandates that are lessening over time, but they're still out there.
You know, it's interesting. I apologize for that car that just drove by right there. It's really interesting. That's a great question, Jason. It depends everywhere you go, right? You go to South Dakota, and you understand why they have a bit of an outbreak, because they don't treat it very seriously. But they also are super rural, right? So everyone's super far out. So if you do have an outbreak, you're really not going to have super infections. And then we were in, you know, the inner city of Baltimore, near Pimlico, and you might see 150 people out at the local mall, not one person wearing a mask, almost everybody who was African-American, right? And it's left me with the thought that groupthink is probably the worst piece to coronavirus. I've also been left that, you know, cities are dying, or at least on life support, and big city mayors in America should probably take a moment to stop bemoaning the evils of Donald Trump after the election and looking at the real trouble their own cities might be in. Because let me be honest, I was in, you know, the only cities that have any sort of life are southern cities like Atlanta, which is a little less stringent. You know, I was on Bourbon Street the day it opened, and it kind of felt like Bourbon Street. But 6th Street in Austin is still pretty dead. Businesses are boarded up all across the country from Boston to Minneapolis. And there's a reckoning of change. And I don't think it's just going to hurt the Democrats, right? All of these people move home who are liberal. And in 2022, Jason, they're going to vote in a new congressional district. And they could swing change, right? Things are really crazy right now. And coronavirus doesn't make me think I have any... there's no way that I have the crystal ball to know what's happening. I just drove around all of America over 45 days before Election Day. So how can the pollsters know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I trust you a little bit more than I trust some of these pollsters. I've been talking with Saul Spady, who is on the road. Thank you so much for giving us that perspective on the election from Colorado. Appreciate your time.
Hey, I appreciate you, Jason. You do some of the best coverage on the election. Your listeners are so lucky to have you in Seattle. We're so lucky to have you in Seattle, kind of bringing that rational opposition voice that we need.
I 100% agree with everything you just said that benefits my career. Thank you so much, Saul.
Talk to you later, Jason.
You've been listening to The Jason Rancher. Thank you so much for tuning in. Really do appreciate it. Coming up next, Ben Shapiro.